Welcome to the Pod Control Podcast, brought to you by Red Hat. PodCTL is your source for containers, Kubernetes, OpenShift, and all things cloud native.
Hello, Kubernetes community, and welcome back to the PodCTL podcast. It is good to be with you again this week. And, you know, as we mentioned last week with Chris Short joining the show as a co-host, we're going to kind of mix up the shows in terms of, you know, having a balance between Chris really covering a lot of kind of community-centric things. He's going to have a new show out this week looking at some community-centric things prior to KubeCon. And I'm going to focus a lot more on some of the OpenShift-centric things. And again, try and find the right balance for you between kind of upstream things in the community, whether it's Kubernetes or Istio or whatever. And then for those of you that want more depth around OpenShift, to provide that as well. So this week, very, very excited to probably have maybe the person who's been around OpenShift as long as anybody within Red Hat, used to be my boss, Joe Fernandes. Welcome to the show. Great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So, Joe, you know, you've been around Kubernetes and OpenShift probably as long as anybody at Red Hat. For those of you that may not know you, maybe have never seen you at KubeCon or never engaged with you, give us a little bit of your background and kind of the scope of the things that you work on related to both Kubernetes and OpenShift.
Yeah, sure. So I've been with Red Hat for over 8 years now. I was brought in as the product manager to deliver the OpenShift 1.0 release. That was all the way back in 2012. Subsequently built out the product management team for OpenShift that's in place today. And then took on some additional responsibilities over the past year and a half. So I'm now the vice president of products for our cloud platforms division. And so that means I run the product management teams for OpenShift, as well as Red Hat OpenStack and Red Hat Virtualization.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. So yeah, when we first got to know each other, you know, OpenShift was just beginning to release OpenShift 3, but you were, you know, and OpenShift 3 is probably the one that most people that are involved with the Kubernetes community will know OpenShift, but you were involved with it before that. Without maybe going all the way back to the PaaS days, give folks a little bit of the background of even just how OpenShift went from being kind of very PaaS-centric, somewhat sort of proprietary, if you will, to thinking about adopting Kubernetes and then making that huge shift.
Yeah, sure. So OpenShift from the start was fully open source, not proprietary, but we were always based around containers technology from the very beginning. But we first got exposed to Kubernetes actually in March of 2019 in a meeting between Red Hat and Google. So our goal for the meeting was to understand what Google's plans were for the Docker open source project, which had come out the year prior. So we had joined that project, started contributing, and Google is really the other company that we saw contributing outside of Docker Inc. themselves. And we want to know, you know, what their plans were for that. So at that meeting were folks like Craig McLuckey, Brendan Burns, Joe Beda, Brian Grant, and so forth, as well as a number of folks on our side. And you know, what we got from that meeting was, you know, Google confirmed that they were all in on the Docker project, that they were going to continue to invest. But they also had a new project for managing Docker containers at scale across multiple machines, multi-container services. And that was at the time called Project 7 of 9. So this is something that we were pretty interested in. I actually wrote a blog about this a few years ago for KubeCon on why Red Hat chose Kubernetes. But at the time, we've been looking at, you know, what were we going to do for managing containers at scale. We looked at things like Mesos, the technology that eventually became Docker Swarm. We looked at building our own homegrown stuff. But ultimately, you know, as I wrote in my blog, Kubernetes stole our hearts. So we decided to join that project. Became part of Google's launch of Kubernetes in July of that year. And then, as you mentioned, a year later, in June of 2015, we released OpenShift 3.0, which was the first commercially supported hybrid Kubernetes solution on the market. And as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah, absolutely. It was it was sort of funny. I was doing a little bit of freelance analyst stuff prior to joining Red Hat and had actually written a market analysis of a lot of different things. OpenShift was one of them. Cloud Foundry was one of other stuff. And OpenShift was really it was just barely 3.0 at the time. And I think I wrote, well, it's, you know, it's nice that Red Hat did that. You know, Cloud Foundry is probably the most mature thing in the market if you're looking for something. And surprisingly, I don't know if it was you directly or somebody from Red Hat gave me a call a couple months later and said, we don't really agree with what you said there, but we like the fact that you have some perspective on the market if you want to come over and help us make OpenShift be more successful. So, you know, one of those don't burn too many bridges things, but kind of a funny way for me to get engaged with you guys originally.
Another great choice by us, yes.
So one of the things I really wanted to spend time with you today talking about was, you know, Kubernetes has now been in the market for, you know, almost 5 years now. OpenShift has been supporting it since, you know, pre-1.0, 1.0. A lot's changed. And, you know, there's a lot that goes into taking sort of the upstream Kubernetes bits and turning that into something that can be usable more as, you know, think of it as like as a platform for companies to deploy applications. And I kind of wanted you to really kind of give folks some perspective on what is that, you know, what does that take to take, you know, the upstream bits? People tend to say like, oh, we'll just use Kubernetes. And then how do you turn that into a platform that can be used, you know, on multiple clouds, you know, enable developers to be successful, all those types of things. So just kind of want to start with that sort of perspective. What are some of the things that Red Hat has to do to turn Kubernetes into OpenShift?
Yeah. So let me start with kind of what we did in the early days back in 2014 and 2015 to get the first product out, right? So again, from the start, Red Hat and Google, you know, were leading the charge in terms of contributing and still are to this day. But we had very different use cases, right? So Google was really investing in Kubernetes for building out GKE, so Kubernetes on the Google Cloud. We were building out a hybrid cloud platform that could run in any public cloud as well as any enterprise data center, right? So we didn't have the advantages of a Google SRE team or all the different advancements that they have in their data centers. So the bulk of our contributions have been towards those types of things, making Kubernetes suitable to run in enterprise customer environments and really across a hybrid cloud environment, you know, that, you know, exists in different footprints. Some of the specific things we built were, you know, early contributions around things like cluster multi-tenancy. So Red Hat contributed extensively to things like Kubernetes namespaces. We built out a lot of the early work around Kubernetes quotas. Roles-based access controls were entirely, almost entirely, you know, contributed by Red Hat because we needed different users to have different roles in the cluster, right? So on GKE, all the users were cluster admin, but in an OpenShift cluster, you had admins who, you know, installed and managed the cluster, but then developers or other end users who could only consume, who could only deploy applications, but couldn't spin up nodes and so forth. So the ability to segment that cluster and share it across multiple users was key and drove a lot of our contributions. The other thing, as I mentioned, you know, enterprise security. So this included things like RBAC, but also kind of security at multiple layers, right? Like within an enterprise construct, authentication and authorization need to be integrated with things like LDAP or Active Directory systems. You also need containers. Yeah, security all the way from the container layer. So we, you know, we integrated things like SE Linux and SecComp into the container runtime, but then also all the way out to the endpoints, right? So you know, our work around network policies and network multi-tenancy, pod security policies, you know, certifications and more. So, you know, again, a big premium on security. And then lastly, and something that we're still doing to this day, is expanding the types of apps you could run on top of Kubernetes and run in containers. So we had a team that was contributing a lot of the storage plugins to enable Kubernetes to work with stateful services. You know, we've built on that now with the release of operators, which allows you to manage those complex stateful services day two. And we continue to do a lot of stuff around, you know, helping customers bring more workloads into that community. And so everything that we've done there is stuff that now benefits all Kubernetes users because, you know, everything goes upstream first.
Right. Yeah. One of the things I always kind of highlight to people is, you know, there is a big difference between, and you mentioned this, you know, running it in an environment in which you control all the variables, you sort of control the hardware, you control the policies around how things are done, and then having to go into the enterprise, which, you know, I don't think anybody ever is going to question saying, hey, look, every enterprise to a certain extent looks like its own snowflake. It has its own sort of convoluted way of doing things that maybe make sense for their business, but, you know, are tied to politics, are tied to regulation. And that's a hard thing to do. It's a lot of work to be able to say, yes, we can put Kubernetes in those environments. So, I think it's a huge sort of important thing. The other thing that you were sort of hitting on there at the end was, there's a bunch of work to make more types of applications run on Kubernetes. I sometimes get people say, well, you know, Kubernetes has a bunch of built-in kind of patterns. You know, there's jobs and there's deployments, and but what more would you have to do to get new types of applications to run on Kubernetes? I mean, is there other stuff that has to go on to that is needed?
Yeah. So this encompasses work within Kubernetes itself, and then work around Kubernetes, right? So within Kubernetes, you know, there's things like, you know, how do you manage state for storage for stateful services? How do you add different types of controllers, right? So when Kubernetes started, it was, you know, it was really just replication controllers and then replica sets. Then we contributed to stateful sets, and now there's all sorts of different controllers as well as ways to extend the platform through CRDs, which is another thing that Red Hat invested heavily in. So certainly quite a lot within Kubernetes. More recently, we've done work around the scheduler, right, to deal with different types of applications like the work we recently announced with NVIDIA to enable GPU-enabled applications, right? In order to run applications that require GPU capabilities, the scheduler first has to be able to detect that nodes with GPUs actually exist, right? And then be able to schedule those workloads appropriately on the nodes that have that capability. But that extends to other things like NUMA affinity and things like that and so forth. So a lot of stuff within Kubernetes itself. But then the other thing that people forget is that there's a lot of stuff around Kubernetes, right? So Kubernetes, is not a full-blown distribution. I always describe Kubernetes as being more like a kernel, right? So it's actually the kernel of your distributed system. So in the same way that the Linux kernel manages processes on a Linux server, right? You need more than just that kernel to run Linux applications. You need Linux distributions that have all the capabilities around that. It's the same thing with Kubernetes. So anybody that takes Kubernetes from the upstream and tries to run applications on it realizes that, well, first you need a Linux host to run it on. Then you probably need some kind of SDN solution to manage the interconnections between all your containers and pods. Then you need a way to get traffic into the cluster. So you're looking at an ingress load balancer of some type. Then you probably want to manage logs for your applications. You probably want to monitor those applications as well as the infrastructure that it runs on. You want to be alerted when issues go wrong. And so there's quite a lot that goes into actually building what we believe is a Kubernetes distribution or a full-blown Kubernetes platform. That's the types of things that we try to do with OpenShift. And that's not even getting into the things that run on top, right? So how are you going to tie that Kubernetes platform into your build systems, into your CI systems, into your CD pipelines and so forth? And so there's a lot of things that we've done and continue to do to really make OpenShift the most comprehensive Kubernetes platform on the market. And then, work with customers to determine which of those capabilities make sense for them in a sort of a batteries included but optional paradigm, because they can bring their own SDNs, their own CI and CD tools if they choose to do so, or use stuff that we provide in the platform itself.
Yeah, I think you've told me this before. I think I've heard you mention this to various companies who've sort of said, hey, we think we might want to just use the upstream. We use the upstream bits. We'll kind of build it ourselves. Can you give us a sense, even if it's just sort of rough numbers or rough ideas, like how many typically how many bugs might Red Hat typically fix between an upstream release of Kubernetes coming out and that getting into OpenShift? And then, maybe how many types of integrations, you mentioned things like SDNs and storage, and like how many types of integrations would you typically have to do above and beyond Kubernetes? I'm trying to get a sense of if I wanted to build something myself, like how many things am I having to do above and beyond that on an every quarter basis to keep maintaining this platform?
Yeah. So, again, let me talk in terms of the engineering team that my PMs work with, right? So we have a core Kubernetes team, and it's one of the largest Kubernetes teams on the planet, only rivaled by Google. And we are building that upstream, right? So we are contributing to the Kubernetes upstream and building every single release that comes out every 3 months. And really that's core to our business, is to have those upstream contributors. But as you mentioned, and as we've talked about in the past, Kubernetes is a project, right? Kubernetes is a project, and projects, open source projects for us, are about innovation and driving that pace of innovation as fast as we can. When you put it in an enterprise organization, you know, sometimes that's not what they're looking for, right? They're looking for enterprise products that they can run their business on top of, right? They're running mission critical banking applications or government applications or retail applications, right? And so while they want to, you know, take advantage of all the latest and greatest innovations, they want to do it in a way that's safe, that's secure, that's reliable, because ultimately the innovation that they care about the most is their own innovation. And so, that's really the difference between Kubernetes as an upstream project and the work we do there, and then OpenShift as our enterprise Kubernetes platform or product that we sell and support to customers. Now, in terms of your question, there's every time an upstream release comes out, we spend anywhere from several weeks to several months doing additional testing beyond that release. And we do identify bugs, sometimes a handful, sometimes, 100 or more that then get backported and into the upstream and also make it out in our release. But a lot of those bugs aren't necessarily just in Kubernetes. They're in all these other systems that Kubernetes needs to integrate with, right? Like, how is Kubernetes interfacing with your SDN? How's it working with the logging stack? How's it working with the operating system itself, right? There's sometimes issues in the kernel that may affect how your containers are running or, how they're being managed. And again, as the only vendor that really supports that entire platform end to end from Linux core to a full-blown Kubernetes platform in OpenShift and all the integrated pieces, it's incumbent on us to actually provide something that's safe and reliable. And again, that customers can trust, and that's kind of how we've made our mark.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And mentioned, it takes a lot of people to be doing that. These folks spend all of their time focused on Kubernetes, on integration with Istio, with all these different, with the operating system. This isn't sort of a part-time sysadmin type of job who also, manages your Linux or is a Cisco admin or something. These are people doing this full-time with sort of years of experience. One of the things that comes up all the time on Twitter and various conversations is people say, Kubernetes is hard to run. It's a distributed system. It's complicated. There's a lot of moving parts. And sometimes you'll hear people say, look, nobody should run their own Kubernetes. Nobody should manage their own. Just, get it from one of the cloud providers. OpenShift obviously has a number of customers who would sort of probably dispute this, and they say, look, for various reasons, we need to run it ourselves. We want to run it ourselves. We need to run it consistently on multiple clouds. What does OpenShift do to say, look, how do we close that gap between somebody else managing it for you and a lot of automation being built into the platform so that you don't have to worry about, a lot of different aspects of it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is core to our business, right? OpenShift is a hybrid Kubernetes platform for the enterprise, which means it has to run consistently across every major public cloud, as well as different footprints within the data center, from bare metal to different virtualization platforms like vSphere, Hyper-V, to private cloud technologies like OpenStack, right? We want one platform that can provide that consistent abstraction across all those different layers, and now increasingly even out at the edge, which is another thing that we see growing interest in. So obviously the alternative to that is to get Kubernetes from each of the providers, right? Kubernetes from your cloud provider of choice. I think the challenge is, ultimately we see customers, they're not going to run their applications only in one public cloud or only in one footprint, in the data center, for example. They're going to run it in the data center and across multiple clouds. And so it's impossible for all of that to be consistent across vendors, right? So the choice then becomes on the customer. Do they want to manage that inconsistency themselves, or do they want to rely on a vendor like Red Hat to do that, right? And that's the business that we're in. Now, to your earlier question, Kubernetes is not trivial to run. We certainly know that as well as anyone, having been in this business now, going on our fifth year. I think we did a lot of good things in OpenShift 3 to make it easier to run Kubernetes, to make it easier to install, easier to upgrade, easier to manage. But that was also a big focus of OpenShift 4, which we just announced this fall. So if the big bet of OpenShift 3 was on the platform, on Kubernetes and containers on Linux, OpenShift 4 was about extending that platform bet, but then also making a new bet on a new way to manage that platform. This encompassed our acquisition of CoreOS, which is now... was about 2 years ago now, And with that acquisition, we got a lot of great people as well as a lot of great technology, which then we put together with our OpenShift team and our broader Red Hat crew, and built OpenShift 4, which brought a fully operator-driven installer that really makes install as well as upgrades seamless, right? So so I think everybody's heard about operators. That was one of the core innovations that the CoreOS team drove. Operators now weaved into our installer. It's everything that is part of OpenShift is installed and managed by an operator. We're also bringing that to our ISV partners so they can make it more easy to manage Kubernetes services day two for their own software. But we're also extending the boundary of the platform, right? So we took the CoreOS container Linux technology and turned that into RHEL CoreOS. So this is RHEL CoreOS is an immutable Linux operating system, but it's one that's fully managed by the platform, right? So you don't install RHEL CoreOS and then install OpenShift. You install OpenShift and then it installs RHEL CoreOS for you. So the operating system is now just a feature of your Kubernetes platform. And then when you need to patch or update that, you do it in an immutable way as you get new updates as part of OpenShift. So a new release of OpenShift or a zStream release of OpenShift may include new features or zStream bug fixes for things like Kubernetes, for Prometheus, for Elasticsearch, for the SDN. But it also could include patches as well as updates for the operating system itself, which is RHEL CoreOS. You can bring traditional RHEL, RPM-based RHEL instances to the OpenShift 4 platform. But if you want something that's fully managed, you get RHEL CoreOS. And then lastly, we extended it all the way down to that infrastructure layer, right? So we actually try to bootstrap an entire cluster for you, including configuring the underlying provider, whether that provider is Amazon or Azure or Google or OpenStack or even Bare Metal. We try to do that for you so that, again, we can take work away from our administrators and allow them to put more of their focus on the things that really matter to them, which is all of the stuff that runs on top of the platform. So that's kind of the objective of OpenShift 4 and why we're so excited about it.
Yeah, there's, the thing, and I don't know if it's as well understood as maybe it needs to be. A lot of the times I hear from people, they go, well, we've looked at some of the, say, the managed Kubernetes services, an EKS or an AKS or something, and they go, you know what I like about that is there's so many things that I don't have to think about. Like, they just set up the network for me, and they set up my masters for me, and they just, they sort of, it plugs into DNS and it's taken care of. And then they'll say, well, but, maybe I like something like a Fargate, because I don't even then have to think about, the nodes or the hosts or the operating systems, and it sort of scales for me. And, a lot of times I kind of have to come back to them and go, a lot of those things are now in OpenShift, right? They're just sort of, they're there by default. If you allow the system to do that, if you allow it to do sort of fully automated installations, it will take care of all that for you. It'll set up sort of best practices. It'll, manages the OS. So I think, a lot of the things that people maybe like about some of the managed services, but especially in the cases where, they need a little more control over it. Maybe they know they have to be in multiple locations. Looking at really what's under the covers in OpenShift 4, I think is going to be pretty surprising to them as to, all of the things that have gone into there in terms of making it, again, fully automated, just does things for you. You don't have to think about scaling, sort of built in now. The nodes are built in. It's really, really a big step from OpenShift 3.
Yeah, I mean, it was our goal in OpenShift 4 to build, a fully autonomous or, self-managing platform, right? Again, from the infrastructure layer all the way up to the operating system, Kubernetes, and your application services. And that's why, the technologies I mentioned were key to that: operators, RHEL CoreOS, machine controllers, which allow you to spin up, new machines to add capacity to your cluster or remove capacity. Also important to note that we do offer OpenShift as well as a fully managed service, right? So when you get it as software that you manage, that's OpenShift Container Platform. But we do have OpenShift Dedicated, which is a managed service for OpenShift delivered by Red Hat on Amazon and on Google as well, coming soon. We also have Azure Red Hat OpenShift that we jointly manage with the Microsoft team, Microsoft Azure team. We now have OpenShift available on the IBM cloud as a fully managed service. We have OpenShift delivered through other service providers, T-Systems in Europe, Telstra and others. So we have quite a number of partners that, if you do want a fully managed service and just consume Kubernetes or consume OpenShift, you can do that too. The difference is it's the same platform, right? It's the same platform, whether we're going through one of our providers or, you know, delivering it as software that you manage yourself. And that's really, really important.
Yeah. We've spent a lot of time today talking about Kubernetes, right? Getting it from an upstream project into a product, into a platform, making the platform, production ready with all the other integrations you need. Ultimately, platforms are only valuable if they're getting applications deployed. What are some of the, how do you think about engaging with developers? What's sort of the OpenShift philosophy of saying, hey, there are going to be multiple ways to get applications on the platform. Some of them are going to be, newly developed. Other of them are going to be sort of packaged. What's the way that you think about how you engaged with, either a developer or people that are going to bring some sort of packaged application to OpenShift?
Yeah, sure. So obviously, I think the platform is absolutely critical, but the most important thing is the people that are building on that platform, right? So this is your developers and your DevOps engineers that are actually making use of Kubernetes to do, their development, their deployments to manage applications all the way out into production. And it's something that we spend a lot of time on, and something, again, that I would consider another one of the big bets in terms of some of the new projects that we've invested in for OpenShift 4 that kind of are game changers in terms of essentially building what I think about as a new platform abstraction. So this is projects that some that you've already mentioned or most people have heard about, things like Istio, which Red Hat has been investing in for now more than a year, almost 2 years now, Knative, Tecton, Eclipse Che, and more. And you're seeing that come out now in the form of fully supported products, right? So those are open source projects that we have Red Hat engineers and working together with IBM engineers and Google engineers and VMware and others upstream. But now we're actually bringing them out as fully supported products. So OpenShift Service Mesh, which came out this fall, takes Istio. So it's our supported version of Istio, combines it with things like Jaeger and Kiali and Prometheus and so forth to deliver a fully supported service mesh solution for enterprises today running on OpenShift 4X. OpenShift Serverless, that just reached technology preview, which is like the last phase before full general availability. That's our commercial offering of the Knative project, giving you sort of a hybrid serverless offering that, again, you can run on Kubernetes across multiple clouds. OpenShift Pipelines, this is a little bit further behind, but it's released, reached a dev preview stage, which is like an alpha stage. But this is based on Tecton, which was carved out of the Knative project, but basically provides Kubernetes native CI and CD capabilities that can be integrated into your existing build tools and processes. And then Code Ready Workspaces, that's our Eclipse Che-based solution for cloud native development, allowing you to do code development in the browser, collaborate with other developers on projects and so forth. And then we've wrapped this all around new developer experience with OpenShift 4 developer console, some new CLIs to make developers more productive. But again, at the end of the day, it's about making those developers want to use that platform and use it productively from development all the way through getting their applications out to production.
Yeah, and I think what it really sort of highlights is, maybe in a given group within a company, they may have all sort of agreed on one standard for how they're gonna write code or push an application, but across groups within one company or across many companies, you're typically going to find a lot of variation. And, part of this has already been confirmed. We look in the market and we see kind of all these different new projects spring up of, hey, what if we, wrote code and interacted with Kubernetes this way or that way? I think one of the lessons that the OpenShift team has sort of learned from going all the way back to sort of the past days when things were really opinionated is opinions are great, except people have lots of different ones. And so if you don't support their ability to have different engagement models, you're going to find that they're often going to say, well, this thing is too limited for what I can do. And I think it's been really interesting to watch the mix of people that say, yep, we just like to push code, and they'll use S2I or other tools like that. Some people are beginning to love operators, which is just take it. It has day one and day two built in. And then you have everybody in between of saying, maybe I like a Helm chart, maybe I want to just bring my own container, and you've got to be able to support all of those really, really well so that you know, at the end of the day, it's, I want to get as many applications as possible on the platform because it drives down the platform costs, it drives down the operational costs, and makes developers happy.
Exactly.
Hey, last thing I want to talk about, we'll wrap this up. You know, there's a bunch of things we'll have to do as sort of follow-ups. you know, one of the things that comes out of interacting with the cloud, and I think the public cloud experience has driven a lot of, you know, you've talked about this, driven a lot of what's in OpenShift 4 now, being able to take some of those experiences that people like, the frictionless that people like, put that into a hybrid cloud platform. One of the things that people don't think about a lot is, you know, if you're running something on a public cloud, in the background, there's a lot of knowledge that cloud is learning about your interaction models. It's saying, hey, what tools are you using? Kind of what interactions do you have? And then how do you make that better, right? You know, they're trying to figure out what services are used together the most? How do we try and help be proactive? What are some of the things that are now in OpenShift 4 to help create sort of a better customer experience, a more proactive way to say, here's a better way to use the platform. Here's what we can learn about making you more successful.
Yeah. So one of the last, you know, things that, you know, I didn't get to yet in terms of OpenShift 4 is something called the connected customer experience, right? So with OpenShift 4, you know, we have quite a lot of telemetry for customers to make use of, things like Prometheus and Grafana, and for both metrics as well as alerts. We have Elasticsearch and Kibana for logs and log management and so forth. So there's a lot of telemetry in the cluster for our customers to use for administration. Customers can then also opt in to connecting those clusters to Red Hat, right? So if you run your clusters in a connected manner, then a subset of that telemetry gets sent back to Red Hat so that we can then give you guidance in terms of proactively helping you with any issues or giving you guidance when a new version is available or when you might want to run an update. And so the way to think about this is, you know, think about any of your consumer devices. Think about your mobile phone. Think about your laptops and so forth, right? When Apple or Samsung or any Android vendor has a new version of the mobile OS, you'll get a notification on your phone that, you know, that an update's available. You just click a button and you update that. The same extends to all of the content on your phone. We want to deliver that kind of seamless experience for customers who want to be connected to Red Hat. In addition to that, you know, through our telemetry, we can get information on any failures that might be occurring. So through our telemetry and something called Red Hat Insights, we get information on things like, you know, upgrade failures or operators that are behaving poorly or potentially other issues, you know, known CVEs, for example. With that, you know, we can then combine that with our expertise in both support and engineering to provide that proactive level of support that that customers have come to expect in working, again, with not only consumer-based devices, but also with some of the public cloud services. So it's something that we're really excited about. I think it's a game changer for how we can support customers and support them not just on one cloud, but across, again, a hybrid cloud environment, no matter where they're running. Now, it doesn't mean that every customer is going to be connected. We work with government customers. We work with customers in regulated industries that will not be able to take advantage of that. And so for those customers, we have full disconnected mode operations for running in air-gapped environments, and that's just fine. But for customers that can connect to Red Hat, it's, again, another benefit, another, you know, level of support that we can provide to make their entire experience much more seamless and make sure that we can, you know, resolve issues in a timely fashion so that they can ultimately be as successful as possible with our platform.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, when you sort of take them all together in terms of, fully automating the platform, kind of a big jump from OpenShift 3 to 4, you think about the sort of breadth of the types of applications you can now get on the platform, whether that's, new AI frameworks like TensorFlow, operators, the new development experience. And then you think about kind of the way that you're trying to be more proactive in terms of making people successful with their platform, being able to, proactively, engage with them, makes upgrades simpler. It does really sort of bring together this vision that you guys had, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, around the CoreOS acquisition, which is the platform has to be automated. You have to be able to, be able to scale it automatically and ultimately get people focused more on not building the platform, but, you know, deploying to the platform and using it to solve the business. Joe, real quick, give us a quick preview. I know you're going to be at KubeCon next week. I know you've got a couple of things you're doing at the OpenShift Commons event. If people are going to be attending, I know you're doing an AMA with the product management teams. What other stuff can people expect, maybe if they're at OpenShift Commons next week or at KubeCon, yep, that they should look out for?
So Red Hat will be out in force at KubeCon next week, as we've been at every single KubeCon since its inception. We will have a pre-conference event on Monday, which is the OpenShift Commons gathering. It's actually on a boat, as Brian and I like to joke. So the boat is docked right by the convention center. I think it's going to be a really great day from hearing both from Red Hat customers deploying Kubernetes in production, as well as hearing from some of our engineers and upstream contributors and some other great guests as well. So that's on Monday. If you'd like to go to that event and you want a code, you can hit me up on Twitter or hit Brian up on Twitter. We have our secret ways to get people into these events. So feel free to hit us up if you're looking to attend and you need some assistance. And then on Tuesday through Thursday, we will be at KubeCon presenting at a number of great sessions. So check out the agenda for that. And then also we'll have a booth set up. So stop by the booth, visit us at one of our sessions. And definitely if you can get in a day early, visit us at the OpenShift Commons gathering on Monday. And we'll look forward to seeing you there. So me and my entire team, as well as a number of our engineers and Brian as well, will all be there.
Yeah,
so
very, very cool. Yeah, I'm always amazed at just kind of what it blows people away. Sometimes they'll come by the booth, they'll go, "Hey, I have a question. I'm struggling with this problem or whatever it is," and somebody will be standing around the booth and they'll go, "Oh yeah, I wrote that code upstream in Kubernetes. What do you want to? How deep do you want to get into it?" And it kind of blows people away that, you know, they're not just talking to some marketing person; they're actually talking to the engineers that wrote the code or the product manager that's, you know, lives and breathes it every single day. So, very cool. We will in the show notes, folks, we will get the things that Joe mentioned in terms of some of the blogs he's written, kind of very good historical context of how we got here, how Red Hat's been involved with the Kubernetes community, and how we've sort of turned it into OpenShift. So, Joe, as always, thank you for your time today. We will see you next week out in San Diego. And folks, as always, if you have questions, you can hit us up, podctl@gmail.com or @podctl on Twitter. With that, we're going to wrap it up. We will talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Pod Control Podcast. You can find everything about the show at podcast.podctl.com or at podctl on Twitter.